Bien, je vous remercie de vous asseoir. Nous allons commencer le séminaire. C'est l'heure. Et j'ai la très grande joie aujourd'hui d'accueillir David Popple. I'll switch to English to mention that David Popple is a research director at the Max Planck Institute in Frankfurt. Thank you. I was not sure suddenly. Frankfurt. And this is a very new venture by the Max Planck. The Max Planck have a visionary attitude to science, and this is a new venture which is called the Institute for Empirical Aesthetics. So think about it. We have a brain scientist collaborating with humanities professors to try to define what makes something aesthetic, pleasurable, but also looking at analyzing the structure. And I think this is mostly what we are going to hear about today, analysis of the structure of the language system and spoken language comprehension. David is a very famous user of techniques such as magnetoencephalography and electroencephalography to study high levels of brain function. He's also a major defender of the idea that brain oscillations play a major role in computation in the brain. And so thank you, David, for coming to tell us about it.
Thank you. Is the microphone turned on and you can hear me? Thank you so much, Stan, for inviting me. And let me apologize that I'm speaking in English. I feel it's uncivilized, especially in current political times. It would be much more appropriate to speak in any other language than English, perhaps. Unfortunately, my French is not good enough to speak about research, but you can ask me questions in other languages. You're very lucky to have courses like this here and to have Stan here, who's of course a leader of cognitive science and an architect of many of the ideas we investigate. So I'll try to give you a view of what's ostensibly a very simple conceptual problem and try to show you a little bit of incremental progress or models or hypotheses. As you know, they surely must be wrong, because everything is more complicated than we think. But I hope that they're wrong in an interesting way, in a way that moves us forwards into exciting direction. So I'll try to build the story for you kind of incrementally, much like language processing goes, and show you where I think there are openings for contemporary research with new techniques and new ideas. So the central topic is about spoken language comprehension, which, if I'm speaking clearly and in a reasonable way, you're currently doing. So stuff is getting to you. So let's start with a very simple example. So here's the example of a sentence. Let's take a sentence like, cats and crocodiles don't play together, which is true. And so you see up here, this is a waveform of sound. This is the sentence as it exits my mouth. Becomes a mechanical vibration in the air, and something like this reaches your ear. Right? So it's just a waveform of air, which is pretty amazing, and it has to be translated into abstract properties in your head. So the things we have to do as you hear me say anything at all is take this from an input of the ear, this kind of information, and then extract all kinds of subtle signals. So for instance here, this is a sentence written down in terms of the details of the sound structure. So here, cats and crocodiles don't play together. And if you analyze, so this is the time axis. So the sentence is about 3 seconds long. And this is the frequency axis. And you see when you analyze something, this is called a spectrogram. Many of you will have seen this before. Some people call it a sonogram. And in a spectrogram, you can see there are little acoustic features, bursts of energy, which have particular characteristics. So here we say there's a burst of energy here, a consonant burst, and there may be little transitions or the voice doing something. And the traditional way of analyzing this problem is to go through and say, oh, my brain, my ear and brain have to take this apart and identify all the little pieces and then pull out the information like that this acoustic segment corresponds to cats. And this acoustic segment corresponds to the word crocodiles, and so on and so forth. You get the general idea. So you have to do some very fine-grained analysis. On the other hand, clearly, you're not very interested. You're not sitting here to understand, that there's a single vowel and that there's some voicing here or that there's some burst of sound. What you're interested in is taking the words, identifying them, and concatenating them into some structure that you interpret. I mean, you're interested in understanding something like they don't play together, right? That's really what's at stake. So you must be able to extract individual parts, like the words, and then concatenate them into some structural information. And so I want to talk about both of those parts today. One is, how do you actually segment the information into usable primitive elements, like the Lego blocks of comprehension? And then how do you assemble the Lego blocks into structural representations that underlie the interpretation? So those are kind of the two parts. They're very straightforward, and I hope to give you some experimental examples of how we think about the problem. So let's zoom in on the first problem a little bit more. So what I call from vibrations in the ear to abstractions in the head. Here's the information that the ear gets, as I just told you, a very just mechanical waveforms. Literally, your eardrum is being vibrated, like, you know, banging against the head. Then something more complicated happens in your brain. So maybe you like to use some tools like MATLAB. This is like MATLAB in the brain. So this is time and this is frequency again. And you do a kind of decomposition of the signal that comes to your ear in the brain. So far, we're talking about physics. Now we're talking about neuroscience. Now we're talking about magic. And next we're talking about linguistics. So here's, for instance, to stay with the example of cat, here is the word cat decomposed into its formal linguistic representation. So what you have in your head when you understand the word cat, or you speak the word cat, you represent the word cat, is, among many other things, the formal specifications of what underlies these individual segments. These are called distinctive features in the literature of linguistics, and you have to extract all of these bundles of information and then put them into their correct order to extract something like this. So we've gone from physics to neuroscience to linguistics, and we're, of course, missing some intermediate step. I mean, how do you get from one kind of information to the other kind of information? That's one of the challenges. Now, lest you think I'm a kind of dour formalist, when I say cat, obviously you also get cat things. So the meaning of cat stuff, right? So you represent a little cat, a cartoon of a cat, but also like cat woman, because it's related to cats, is activated automatically in your head, or caterpillar, which has nothing to do with cats, but starts with the syllable cat. So when you hear this, all this information is automatically activated in your head. So our job is to figure out, how do you go from this continuously varying waveform to your ear up? This is unfortunately not a super great pointer. There we go. That's powerful. So how do we go from this continuously varying wave, there's no breaks in there, to something that's segmented and discretized in some specific sense? It's not so clear how to do that. And that's one of the things I want to show you a potential solution for. Now, the other part of the problem is, of course, once you have all the building blocks, how do you put them together? I mean, you need to put them together into larger units that underlie interpretation. So depends on the theory of structure building, and this is a very contentious area of research at the moment. So how do you actually take words and put them together such that they're either just sequences, just a string of beads, like a chain, like a beautiful pearl chain from Saint-Germain in an elegant shop, or is it more like a sculpture, like an Alexander Calder, with complicated structural relationships between them? Those are kind of the alternatives that we have to think about. And what has to happen in your head is that some sentence has to, in the end, have some representation. This is the sentence, the dog saw a man in the park. Sorry, you can't see it very well. The dog saw a man in the park. And ultimately, you build up an internal mental representation of these structural relations. And so it starts with very little. Something like a word comes in, like the, and then you have to slowly and iteratively build up these structures. They get larger and larger, and as information comes in, you build these what are putatively abstract representations. So far, so good? I mean, this pretty abstract process. If you like, if you feel strongly inclined, let's say, towards the world of Google, it looks more like this. So this is an implementation of a particular parser, the one that Google currently favors. So you see, you have to do iteratively a step of little computations, taking some item, taking another item, relating it to the first one, relating it to the second one, and sequentially going through. That's sort of the kind of stuff that happens. Okay, so what is in common between these? I mean, something is tricky to solve here. Well, the larger scale commonality that I want to kind of sensitize you to requires that we zoom out 1 second or 30 seconds to how we think about time more generally in processing. And the way we usually do is through the lens of Newton. I mean, Newton's classical, in the classical sense of mechanics, Newton had a very specific notion of time, which is, in some sense, the cartoon is time flies like an arrow. And his definition, which I think is very beautiful, is absolute, true, mathematical time of itself and by its own nature flows equably without relation to anything external, which is very hard to understand in English, but it means that. And what's your intuition? Your intuition about how time is processed is also a very continuous experience. And so you have the experience of the world happening to you, not in a sort of chopped up way. But one of the messages and one of the kind of underbellies of the processing we do in our head is that it's actually rather more segregated. That is, although we experience it as an arrow of time or a continuous variable, it's really chopped up into islands of sequential chunks. And even more particularly, and this is kind of speaks to the talk throughout, what happens is that you do it on multiple time scales. So under the hood, if you're thinking about this like a car, you're a car mechanic, you're taking the car apart because it's an old deux chevaux or something, and you have to look in the engine, fix it. In the engine, you see this. This is actually the structure of the machinery, but your experience of this is a very continuous thing. So we have to chop things up into smaller units that we use for information accumulation and the computations underlying. So far, so good? So you do something that's completely unanticipated. Okay, now I want to relate these things between brain and language. I want to try to figure out how do these potential ideas relate. And there I want to, staying at the zoomed out level for 1 second before we go to experimental research, tell you what the possible options here are. Because as somebody who works on brain and language for a few years now, it's not so clear what the end game is. It's not immediately obvious. So let me give you the possibilities. Let me first give you a nice quote about language. Here's an example of language. Anyone who seriously approaches the study of linguistic behavior, whether linguist, psychologist, or philosopher, or neuroscientist, must quickly become aware of the enormous difficulty of stating a problem which will define the area of his investigations and which will not be either completely trivial or hopelessly beyond the range of present-day understanding and technique. I think it's a good example of language, and it's actually from a very famous article. It's from a paper by Noam Chomsky from 1959, critiquing Skinner's book, Verbal Behavior. It's one of the kind of founding documents of modern cognitive science. And if you haven't read this review, run, don't walk, to the library and read this very influential paper. It's quite astonishing. If you are in the sciences and you deal with reviewers, this is the ultimate reviewer number three. This is the reviewer number three that takes the rug out from under you forever. But it's a nice example of language, and actually it captures a good idea. Are we in fact capable of answering deep questions? Now here's an example of a brain. You've seen many of those in Stan's course. And you might ask yourself, well, why should I bother studying these together? I mean, it's not... So why do this? What could we possibly learn? And I think there's three possibilities, and all of them have to be weighed carefully. So one possibility, which is the most optimistic one, is that by studying the brain, we're going to learn something about how language works. As we're going to, in different experimental setups, get deeper and deeper insight into linguistics and language processing more generally. That can happen, but at the moment, I'm not so optimistic. Right? I think if a student came to me and said, I really want to learn something deep about language, then I would send them to study linguistics and not neuroscience. There's another possibility that we learn something about how the brain works. That seems to me at the moment more promising. That is to say, we can use language, which is actually a kind of reasonably well understood computational system, to probe how the brain represents and processes relatively complicated abstract information. So I think that's a little bit more optimistic. But then here's the real possibility, the real danger, is that we learn nothing. That is, it's an example of what I call interdisciplinary cross-sterilization. As, of course, we're asked to be interdisciplinary. All our grant applications, as you know, say, oh, you should be working with, you know, it would be a wonderful collaboration between a syntactician and a geologist, or an astrophysicist and a phonologist, or something like that. But it's not obvious that you actually learn something that you can interpret. But now, on some bad days, I believe that. But let's assume today is a good day, and we proceed. Otherwise, we should stop right now. And so how do we proceed? Well, we try to understand, we break the problem down into smaller problems. We use the method of Descartes, I guess. Discours de la méthode, I think it's called. Probably given in this, you know, somewhere around here. Although I think when he wrote it, he was in Ulm as a soldier. So we make complicated problems and turn them into small problems. How do we do this? So I want to do this sort of like a physicist. That is, I want to identify the elementary particles, or, you know, depends on what your favorite metaphor is, the atoms, the elementary particles, the basic building blocks, the Legos. And to do that, I am going to turn to my colleagues from, let's say, linguistics, if I'm studying language, or music theory, if I'm studying some aspect of music. And how do I do that? Well, I can write to all my friends and colleagues who work in that domain. So suppose I write to everybody in the Linguistic Society of America, or the Deutsche Gesellschaft für Sprachforschung, or, you know, whatever the French equivalent is, and I ask them, look, can you make me a list of the foundational concepts of your discipline such that if you don't have that concept, you can't explain the phenomena anymore? Right? So the primitives of the theory that are constitutive of the domain. So if you don't have them, the range of phenomena you're trying to explain are no longer accessible to you. And you can then come up with many lists, and of course they are debated, but they're going to contain, let's say, concepts such as, let's say, syllable, or the concept of a morpheme, that is, smallest unit that carries meaningful information, or the notion of a clause, or the notion of, you know, a distinctive feature, and so on and so forth. And so you can come up with a list that looks approximately like that. You can do, by the way, the same thing for music. I'm not going to talk about music today, only sort of obliquely, but I made this list with Fred Lerdahl, who's a music theorist and composer at Columbia University, known mostly for a very famous book with Ray Jackendoff, Generative Theory of Tonal Music, and we came up with this kind of list of representational primitives, right? So things like discrete time interval or octave-based pitch scale and so on and so forth. So far, so good? So we make the alphabet. So we have the alphabet for language, we have the alphabet for music, and so that's, we're now in the domain of, let's say, linguistic, music theory, psychology, computer science. Now, what about the other elementary particles? Well, we have to look to the brain. So the brain, of course, has its own hypothesized neurobiological infrastructure. There, you know, I mean, this is the course you're in to some extent, so you know there's many levels of organization, and we're not going to talk about that here. I mean, this is obviously reasonably well understood. There are generalizations or, you know, primitive elements at the level of, let's say, neural circuits on the order of a millimeters, larger maps, let's say maps that encode, for instance, the visual world as retinotopic, or the auditory world as tonotopic. So there's maps at a larger scale. There are smaller organizational networks at the level of synapses and so on. So there's an alphabet or an infrastructure of the brain. So we have the psychology, linguistics. We have the neuroscience. But I need some linking hypotheses to figure out how is one domain processed using the infrastructure of the other domain. And so today I'll turn to, simply as an example, is the intermediate level, and here I'm adopting as a kind of conceptual framework the way David Marr, the computational vision expert, subdivided complicated problems into a kind of computational level of analysis, what are you trying to solve, an algorithmic level of analysis, how are you going to do that, and an implementational level of analysis, how are you actually going to build it out of wetware, hardware, and so on. So
what I'm arguing is that some of these algorithmic operations actually hold across domains, and the kinds of things that happen in your head are things like discretizing information.
That's how we started with the speech example. You have to discretize cat, and you have to pull it out.
Building hierarchies, or grouping operations, or processing over multiple scales.
And so now I'm going to turn to some experimental work, and not very, you know, not fun, I hope fun for you to understand and to follow along,
that make arguments for why these are basic computations or basic operations that can begin just by hypothesis to form some linking hypotheses between the, you know, the humanities parts of the experiment of the work and the neurobiology. So that's where we're going. Still with the program? Still good? Okay, now, how am I going to tie it all together? The concept that I'm using was Stan mentioning earlier is one of the ideas I've been thinking about for a few years, the concept of neural oscillations. So neural oscillations, you can have kind of a technical interpretation and a non-technical interpretation. Let's start with a non-technical interpretation. It's information that you record when, you know, here's a brain plugged in electrically, and when you record it, you see signals from the brain varying at different rates. And so informally, you might think of this as the brain breathing. So these are different rates of information. So there's shallow breathing or fast breathing, and there's slower breathing, and there's very slow breathing. So when you record a brain using an electrophysiological technique, like EEG, MEG, electrocorticography, so recordings from the surface of the brain in a clinical context, or in animal preparations, local field potentials, this is the kind of signal you see. And more particularly, what you see, and this we'll get into in a little bit more detail, are signals that look like this, that have this great regularity. They're called oscillations because they oscillate, right? So when you record a signal from the surface of the brain with any of these techniques, let's say EEG, which you've seen before, electrodes are glued to your head, and you measure voltage differences, very straightforward, very cheap, widely used, extremely effective technique. You see a signal like this, right? Up and down, up and down. But we also know that a signal like this is combined out of elementary parts of different frequencies. So there are slower oscillations. For instance, here one that we call, you know, in the delta range, so low frequencies. So maybe one cycle, informally speaking, once a second approximately. Then there's sort of intermediate ones, which we call the theta band, let's say between, you know, 5, 6, 7 cycles per second, pum, 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 something like that. And then much faster ones. For example, one that's studied a lot is the gamma band in the range of, you know, 30 to 50 hertz or something like that. So when you measure from the brain, what you measure is fluctuating activity, oscillating activity at different rates. Very fast ones, medium ones, slow ones. Now, this is not a lecture about how these things are generated. There's a huge amount of research on exactly what generates these things, where are they coming from. They're actually in many parts of the brain. Here is what you should remember for cocktail party or for white wine party. There are some things we agree on and some things we clearly don't disagree on. We don't agree. So we agree on, one of the things that's more well understood is that these oscillations have some kind of homeostatic functions. That is, they keep the operating system in a functioning intermediate regime. So these are, you know, the origin of these things are fluctuations of current flow across membranes. And they keep it, essentially you can think of it as keeping it from being epileptic. So that's not controversial. Controversial is that this kind of brain activity is exploited for computation in the brain. That is, it's actually a feature, or it might be there for homeostatic function, but has clear consequences for processing, for perception, for cognition, and so on. That's what I'm going to adopt. I'm going to adopt that these two are kind of reasonable hypotheses. But there's a large range of colleagues, quite a few of them here in Paris, not so far away, a few blocks up, who think that it's completely not reasonable. That is, that oscillatory activity in the brain is simply epiphenomenal. That is, that you can, the exhaust fumes of cortical computation. So, you know, you're driving along and then you're just, and I don't know what that's called, you know, in German it's the Auspuff. Literally the exhaust fumes. So if that's true, then we shouldn't be working on this, right? That would be unhappy. But let's assume that these are reasonable things. Okay, so we have some big problems. We have the problem of how do you segment speech? We have the problem of how do you put speech together? We approach it by looking to the cognitive sciences, by looking to, let's say, linguistic theory, and we approach it by the neurosciences by looking to this concept, the concept of cortical oscillations. So now I'm going to give you just two slices of experiments that tell you that this is actually an interesting way, at least to an interesting lens through which to explore this problem. So let's start with the first one, which is, I think, pretty straightforward, and it's very important because it's the foundation for the second set of experiments. So try to read this. This is the audience participation part. So this is where you should be irritated, right? Because it's annoying. Since there are no word boundary signs in spoken language, the difficulty we feel in reading and understanding the above paragraph provides, and so on and so forth. Now, reading is really cool because it doesn't have this problem. Reading has little signs in between, little white spaces. So what are the white spaces good for? Well, they segment the information for you in a very clear way. They tell you one form of the unitization. So you know where to look and what to group and what to ungroup. But speech is not like that. Speech is like this. So there are no little white spaces in speech, for better or for worse, because we don't speak like this. It would be very annoying. So we have to solve the problem of our sentence, cats and crocodiles don't play together, with no obvious breaks that tell you this is a word, this is a morpheme, this is a syllable, and so on. We have to solve the problem in a bottom-up way, given the signal and given what's in our head. So how do we do that? Well, here's one of the things we've discovered in the last few years. Note one of the features. So classical speech recognition research, and actually all of automatic speech recognition research up to, let's say, 2 weeks ago, where I attended a meeting about this, deals with this kind of representation. So this is, again, time. So this is about 3 seconds of a sentence. This is the frequency of the information in the signal. And the hypothesis is that both brains and computers simply go left to right. They start here, and they take little slices, usually about 20 milliseconds, and they analyze to death these little slices, and then they concatenate them. That is the standard view. But notice when you see what arrives at the ear and the cochlea, there's actually this big information, these big bumps and valleys. That is what we call the envelope of the signal. So this is a big amplitude deviation. So the signal gets, in some sense, louder, softer, louder, softer, louder, softer. Right? So that correlates with basically when your mouth is wide open, when I say, hello. You know, are you awake? Right? So that corresponds with these big bumps. Now, that information hasn't been particularly used. It turns out to be immensely useful, which I want to, in the next 10 minutes or so, convince you of. So what is it? We call it the envelope because it's like an envelope around the speech signal. Okay, what can you find out? Suppose I take one of these electrophysiological techniques, such as EEG, MEG, electrocorticography, anything. One thing that's been observed very robustly now for many years is that when you take this envelope of the speech signal, there's these big fluctuations of what's coming to your ear, the brain actually locks directly to the signal. And we call that entrainment. That is, the brain signal entrains or locks on to the speech waveform. And you can think of it as the waves of the brain surfing on the waves of the speech in a very close correlation. So they sit, right on top of each other. So this is quite robust. So we got auditory cortical activity. So that's this part of the brain, right? This is part of the brain in your temporal lobe, kind of conveniently next to your ears, unlike the visual system, right? Eyes are here, visual system here. Good thing about hearing is ears are here, auditory system here. Well designed. So your auditory cortex entrains to this envelope. And you can see that in many different experimental preparations. So let me give you just a couple of examples to assure you that it's not an outrageous finding. So you can do that. This is just participants listening to a story. This is like you. You're sitting there. I can put some electrodes on your head. I can measure the brain activity, and we will find this. So very close following of the thing. Now, suppose I show you a movie. So you're sitting there watching, let's say, a good movie, a French movie, not an American movie. It works there too. So auditory cortex tracks the information that's in the audio track of the movie, but it also tracks the visual dynamics, you know, something that happens there, and vice versa. If I record from the visual cortex, it tracks the visual information, but it also has access to the auditory dynamics. So the brain is very, very tuned to these local dynamic variations and can coordinate them across sensory systems. So both the visual system and the auditory system talk to each other and provide the kind of readout of the subtle dynamics of something. So it works for speech. It works for multi-sensory things. Suppose I do something, you know, more real life, like a cocktail party. Although that's not in my life. I've never been to a cocktail party. That's something from the 50s, I think, from the show Mad Men or something. So imagine you're at a party or at a bar. I have been to a bar. And you're trying to talk to two people. You're sitting there or standing there. And there's a female speaker and a male speaker. And they're talking at the same time. You know, blah, blah, blah. No. Trump is bad. No, he's great. So you have this conversation. And I'm recording you. In this case, it's a little bit more. It's a cocktail party in which the recording happens in a hospital because this is with electrocorticography. So you have implanted electrodes in your brain. That's an unusual situation. Now I ask you, listen to the female speaker two times in a row. So it's the same conversation. So a female speaker and a male speaker saying something, you know, typical experimental work, very boring sentences. And at the end of the sentence, you have to say, you know, give some answer, answer some question. Now, if I ask you to attend to the female speaker, on the first trial, you see the blue line. So this is, you know, 6 seconds of some sentence. And remember, you're hearing a mixture. So you're hearing the female and the male speak at the same time. So your homework is listen to the female speaker and then answer a question about what the female speaker said. You get the blue line. Let's do it again. Second trial. Mixture. Listen to the female speaker. You get the red line. Very close match. Okay, so something, you know, you're really paying attention to the female speaker. Now, identical acoustic stimulus, the male and the female speaking concurrently on top of each other, but now your homework is attend to the male speaker and tell me what the male speaker said in some task, and then it looks quite different, a very different pattern, because you're now entraining to the envelope of the male speaker, not the female speaker. So your brain waves are now attuned or surfing on the male speech waves. Now, when you look at where in the brain that's coming from, how it's organized, it's not in the same places. So you can, for instance, show that the information in the brain signal that tracks both the female and the male speaker at the same time largely comes from the areas around, this is the auditory cortex, right? So the left hemisphere of the human. And each dot is one of the electrodes implanted in the patients. These are patients, you know, that have medically refractory epilepsy. They're being evaluated prior to surgery. And so here's how that looks when you track both of them. But when you track only the speaker that you information you care about, it's a very different distribution of information. So it's a selective tracking of the attendance. Okay, so the entrainment by oscillations is very sensitive. It's sensitive to speech. It's sensitive to multisensory things like vision. It's sensitive to attentional manipulations. Please track this, please track that. And there's basically been a huge number of studies on this, using speech, using non-speech, using music. I mean, it's an orgy of studies. I mean, 20, 30 in the last couple of years. Now, let's go back to the origin of the question. So we've got this entrainment, which I can show you empirically. Now remember that the original speech idea was you have a signal, cats and crocodiles don't play together, and you relate it to some linguistic representation, like the linguistic representation of the word cat, and of course some semantic representation, like this shorthand is the semantics of cat, which has to look a little bit more sophisticated than a picture from the internet, obviously. But what we've now learned is that this envelope information, these big digressions, actually do something very different, seem to be relevant, and on the basis of that, we've developed quite different models of speech recognition. This is one that I've developed with Annelise Giraud, who actually used to be here in Paris, she's now in Geneva, and my colleague Odette Gitza from Boston University, which is a more computational implementation of these ideas. The idea is that these neural oscillations actually interface with the input. And I'll give you one very brief example of it. So the idea is as follows. Here is the speech waveform, just me saying something, continuously varying information. That elicits an activity or spikes or action potentials, as we call them, in the pathway of the auditory system. So it goes from the ear up the food chain that is in the auditory brainstem, the different nuclei of the auditory brainstem, elicits bursts of activity. And these bursts of activity, as they come up the auditory pathways of the brainstem and the cortex, interact with these oscillations. So here you see examples of oscillations, some that are a little bit slower. So these are in the theta range. So let's say about 5 times per second, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, roughly like that, and then much faster ones. So this input that the speech generates interacts with these intrinsic oscillations, that is the breathing of the brain, and that input actually resets these oscillations. It says, the oscillation is happening, it's breathing, it's going 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, and then the input comes and bangs against it and resets where it starts. So it's like making a new window. It says, start again, start again, start again. And each cycle of this oscillation defines a time window. So that is how we think about it. Now, what's the consequence of this? Just like in reading, if this is true, it allows you to actually make little white spaces between the information you interpret. So you come in as a continuous spike train, all kinds of information of the auditory system, but your job is to decode the individual chunks of information. And this is one way to actually make discretized chunks of spikes that you can then decode or read out for subsequent process. So this is a slightly more involved thing. Now, what does this mean? What's the now comes a first public service announcement, something you will want to know. So I'm carrying on about the envelope. You have an envelope of information. Your brain locks onto it. Who cares? I mean, this is some kind of weird feature some neuroscientists thought up. Well, let me tell you that the envelope is super useful. If you calculate the envelope, for instance, for different languages, here it is for Mandarin, English, French, it's always the black line, you can figure out how regular or irregular does it work. So what are the fluctuations of the envelope? Is there any regularity to it? These are languages that are quite different. So French has one kind of temporal structure that's, this is highly debated in the literature. It's more syllable timed, it's called. English is stress timed. Chinese, a very different language. It has just a very simple consonant vowel structure. But you can calculate how much does this rate change. Is the envelope interesting in any way? I won't tell you the details of how to do this, not so interesting. But let me tell you this, which I do find surprising. When you just look at the physics of the signal, the physics of these envelopes, it's extremely regular. I mean, this is not just now on a few sentences, this is now on hundreds of hours of speech, so a very large sample. So this is called the modulation spectrum. So how often does something get loud and quiet and loud and quiet? And if you look at it, it has a very clear, narrow peak. And this peak is between 4 and 5 hertz, so between 4 and 5 times a second. And it doesn't matter whether it's sentences from a kind of artificial thing, conversations, interviews, dozens of hours of audiobooks. So just on the mean, although of course each individual sentence has some shorter and some longer parts, it's highly regular, extremely regular. And you might ask yourself, for the different languages, it's the same. So it's cross-linguistically extremely regular. Now, one more thing, you say, oh, that's 3 languages. No, we can do it for all kinds of languages. So the mean rate of the physical signal changing in large corpora is between 4 and 5 hertz. So now if anyone asks you about the physical rate of speech, this is not yet the syllabic rate, this is the physical rate of speech, it's between 4 and 5 cycles per second. That's on average how fast you speak. It can be a little bit slower, and it can be a little bit faster, but you stay within a pretty narrow range, because in part that's constrained by how you move your mouth, and in part by the operating system of your brain. Okay, so why is this useful? You might say, well, this is another weird thing. This is useful because the time unit that's defined by this modulation of the physical signal relates directly, we've done it for music too, relates directly to syllable size duration cross-linguistically. So if you actually take this envelope and you take a unit of that, what you get is an estimate, a mean of the syllable duration. So here's a recent study, a cross-linguistic study of syllable rate, which is, you know, here it is for English, for Japanese, for German, and so on. Okay, so now we have the story beginning to fit together a little bit. So we put speech into your brain. You're lying in a machine. We record it, and it shows you that the brain locks onto it with oscillations of a certain frequency. We measure the physics of the signal. The physics of the signal tells us it's very regular. Then we look to linguistics, and it says, oh, this matches very closely what syllable rate is like. So now it begins to be kind of useful. So we have an alignment or a linking hypothesis between physics, namely the modulation spectrum of speech, systems neuroscience, which is the theta rhythm, this is the locking on to the envelope, and linguistics, namely syllable duration cross-linguistically. So that's actually useful. How can we make use of this? Well, we make use of this by saying, here's our intuition, here's my sentence, this is the sentence, she had your dark suit in greasy wash water all year, not nice, and here's what it looks like in a spectrogram. So this is more or less as the signal comes up from the ears into the brain, into the auditory cortex. The brain locks onto it, right? So the brain waves, the oscillations lock on, and now you use that to break it apart. So it's a way to segment into coarse temporal chunks, which are then the Lego blocks for the next decoding step. So entrainment can be an extremely useful operation to actually make temporal units of things to then check what is my syllable structure, what are the words I'm looking for. So you've inserted the white spaces where there previously were none. So I think that's pretty useful. So oscillations can form the basis for segmentation or can be one of the operations. There's, you know, many other things to do. That makes sense, sort of? The entrainment is very, very regular and might have something useful to do. So now let me skip ahead a little bit. So now I would be in the real world. I would now tell you in some detail about why you should believe me and why when I make the oscillations go away, it's very important. Maybe in the questions I can give you a brief example of that, because there's some cool experiments we've done to show that if the oscillations aren't there, bad things happen. But let me turn now to I want to build on this concept of entrainment and get to the structure building. And that is a slightly different story. So I first talked about you have to segment a continuous stream, but that's only part of the problem. I mean, really, I want to take connected speech, which is what most stuff is, and then actually figure out how to build it into hierarchical structures, which is what I'm really interested in, because that's what I actually interpret psychologically and linguistically. So this is an experiment that was really worked on most energetically by Nai Ding, who's now a professor at Zhejiang University, and Lucia Meloni, who was at NYU and is now at Max Planck. And it builds exactly on what I just told you. So if you understood entrainment, that is brain oscillations lock to a rhythm of the signal, you'll appreciate this. Okay, ready? Next, so different kind of experiment. So here's a sentence. The sentence is, they went on vacation. The red thing is the envelope, as I told you before. And we know that when you track the envelope, as I just told you, you get a very nice estimate of the kind of early aspects of phonetics. That is, you break into roughly syllable-sized chunks so you can decode and look for lexical information. So that works very nicely. But of course, I'm interested in, let's say, word-level information or syntactic-level information. And on these higher-order levels of representation, there are no cues. Nobody tells you that this is a constituent. That has to come from somewhere else. So can we actually extend our notion of entrainment to the issue of structure building? Very different kind of problem. So here's the rationale of this experiment, which is actually quite simple. You'll see in a second, it's deceptively simple. So here's a sentence, lovely kids eat apples, at the syllabic level of analysis. And I just told you that the neural code for each linguistic unit must change at the rate of that linguistic unit. So suppose I play you that sentence very regularly, lovely kids eat apples at some fixed rate, then whatever is doing the coding, the encoding, and the decoding of that information must be commensurate with this rate. However, if I arrange the items that there are higher orders of information, they must happen at different rates because their information is changing at different rates. So the rationale is, can we use this concept of entrainment to actually find entrainment to stuff that's in your head, that's not in the signal at all? So we know this is correct. We've already done this experiment. You entrain to the physical signal. But what about to the higher order aspects of representation that are not in the signal? Right? So is that even plausible? Can you use the method of entrainment using brain oscillations to information that's not in the stimulus at all? It means you have to build it. So here's the experiment. So we did this experiment at this point in a bunch of languages, but the original version is in Mandarin and English. So let me first show you this. So we build sentences like, for instance, dry fur, rub skin, new plans gave hope. And we present them at an isochronous rate. So very weird, very artificial. Word, 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 word. Moreover, we edit them. We record them individually, and we edit them so that each individual word was very flat and boring and uninformative about its neighbors. So we record the word rubs, we record the word plans, and so on. Then you concatenate them so they're played at a very regular rate. Now, when you do that, and then you arrange the appropriate information, you can make it so that at the phrasal level, so when you build constituents, if you do build constituents, they change at a lower frequency. And if you arrange those to build entire sentences, they're at an even lower frequency. So now you're lying in this machine. This is an MEG experiment. So you're lying in a big hair dryer. You're recording electrophysiological activity from your brain. And you're hearing these continuously. So this is, I'll play you the stimulus in a second, but it's really like, dry fur, rub skin, new plans gave hope, lovely kids, and so very regular. And you do nothing. Every now and then you detect an outlier just to make sure you're still alive. Okay, what does it sound like? Here's what it sounds like in Mandarin. For the Mandarin speakers among you. I thought that was correct. So very boring. If you do this for an hour, right? Imagine lying in the machine for an hour listening to this kind of information and just every now and then executing a task. If this, by the way, for Mandarin speakers, right? Mandarin speakers understand this. Okay, what happens? So we record electrophysiological activity from the entire head, and I just told you earlier, well, the stimulus is happening at a very regular rate, and from all the previous experiments from the last 20 minutes, I told you that the brain completely entrains to that. So if I'm playing it at 4 hertz, I better see something at 4 hertz, otherwise my idea is broken. So we stick some people in. We don't have to worry about that so much. This is what you see. Okay, so this is the part where you go, wow. This is the ooh-ah moment. So here's, let's say, the original stimulus. So this is my little cartoon of the syntax. So this is the sentence. The sentence consists of two constituents, like, angry birds, plays easily. Each of these cherries is one word. And by the way, in Mandarin, the convenient thing is each syllable is also words. It's a good reason to use it. Okay, so this is what you're listening to continuously. When you now look at the brain response in the frequency domain, what do you see? Well, first of all, you see the rate of the syllables in the response, which of course is good because that's all the previous stuff we did. So the rate of the syllable is simply the rate of the stimulus. So since we played the materials at 4 hertz, you get 4 hertz back out. Great news. That's like the reality check. But what you also see, which is remarkable, is peaks at the rate of the phrase, that is, that's always two together, and also a peak at the rate of the entire sentence. So that's, you know, one of these concatenated after another. So this looks like your brain is actually tracking information at the syllable rate, the phrase rate, and the sentence rate at the same time, concurrently. It's actually building multiple units continuously at the same time. So that's pretty cool. This is where you should be like, wow, that's cool. Okay. Now I have to convince you that it's not crazy, right? So let me give you a little bit of additional information about the study. So it works very well with each person. So now you're going to have many objections. So your objections are going to be, for instance, maybe it has nothing to do with the structure. Maybe it's really just a series of words. That's how you process things. You have a sequence of items. And what you're seeing is simply some kind of subharmonics. When I give a very strong stimulus at 4 hertz, you actually have a complicated harmonic structure in both directions. You have harmonics here and subharmonics there. Well, that's not it. Okay, so we brought a new bunch of victims to the lab, new participants. They now get this experiment. They get the experiment of only word lists. You may have heard about this kind of change of, you know, experimenting with word lists and structured representations. I don't know if you guys talked about those experiments. So this should be very familiar to you. This is like a shopping list. Eggs, butter, toast, baguette, you know, no structure there. So this is what you see then. You put new victims into the magnetoencephalography machine, and you see, again, a very strong response to the rate of the stimulus itself, right? So that was at 4 hertz. But you don't see anything at the lower frequencies, so especially not at the rate of phrases or sentences. So it can't have been just some very simple physical model, that is, you extract subharmonics. That's too simple an idea. Okay, let's try something a little bit more subtle. Let's make it a new experiment where we put O is 2 together. So now you still have a list of words happening, but O is adjacent 2s go together in a phrase. So angry birds, red table, you know, something like that. What happens? Well, you recover the original stimulus. That's like your reality check, your sanity check. Is the experiment working? But you also see, again, the peak that goes with the phrasal rate. So that means you are tracking the building of two together. Now let's replicate the original experiment. Make sure we got that right. Okay, good. We get that back with new subjects. So that worked. Now let's try something a little bit more subtle and mix up the structure of the items so that it's not, so that the whole sentence is at 1 hertz, but we change the internal structure. You can do that too. We don't have to worry about it so much. Then you begin to see actually harmonics of the sentence, right? Which is interesting. Okay, so far so good? So it's not something simple, and you're tracking something that is not in the stimulus, so you must have brought it to the party. This grammatical information that you're using to construct information. So let's do a few other things to make sure that we're on the right track. Let's take English listeners now and give them the Chinese materials. So for English listeners, a Chinese sequence is still happening at 4 hertz. It's just an acoustic signal that they can't interpret, so they shouldn't get any of the higher order information, and they get the syllables. Great. So they're tracking the acoustic stimulus, but they're not actually building some mystical structure that's not there. So it really requires knowing the words and the language and the structure building. So that's a nice good. Now let's do, you know, yet another thing, because remember, this is the world of reviewer number 3, reviewer number 4, reviewer number 7. Let's make sure it works for English. So here's what English sounds like.
Poor plant A builds our crossroad, no strong dudes, sand pumps, pump, eggs, waste time, kind words, warm parts, talk, guys, play, camp, mood, cats, claw, dogs, quiet land, age, grass, wood, shelf, holes, can, ice, beer, cost, sense, new plants, give, hope, large hands, felt, nest.
It's horrible. I mean, imagine doing that in any language. But that's what experimental work is like. It's an exercise between creativity and suffering. The experiment works again for English speakers. So make sure it's not in our, so we have in English, we've done it also actually in Hebrew and French, we've done it in German, so it's pretty generic. We can use it now as a method to test ideas. Okay, so quick conclusion for this part now is, so the cortical activity that we see is entrained, as I told you in the first part, to the phrasal and sentential rhythms of speech, but they're not in the signal. They're not there. And it must be, so it works for English and Chinese, and it can't be that you're tracking something about the acoustics because we got rid of the acoustics. Each word was recorded individually, it had no intonation contour, there were no cues, so it can't be just you're tracking interesting acoustic information, which, you know, we know you do. We tried to eliminate it. Okay, now comes a tricky part. We think this is a very reasonable way to proceed because we're informed by the ideas of linguistic theory that you actually do build structures. But a very reasonable and important objection is to say, look, we don't build structures. We simply track statistical relationships between sequences, between items and the inter-item relationships, transition probabilities, say. So you're not actually tracking structure at all. You're just tracking adjacent probabilities. So for that experiment, we have to do something a little bit different. We now bring a new batch of participants, or victims, to the lab. They now get exposed to a fake little toy language that we teach them. And that toy language has the very annoying property of no matter where you are, you have a 1/5 chance to be near the next item, right? So it has a fixed transitional probability between every item, between sentences, within sentences. So now you have the horrible task of coming to the lab, spending some quality hours listening to this junk, to make sure you kind of press in the notion of regular transition probability. And this is what this sounds like. This can really make you crazy. This is like migraine inducing.
John C. Scotch Perdak wrote a book. Perdak speaks French. Chess wrote a poem. Perdak didn't answer. The girl speaks Russian. The boy wrote a story. The boy didn't move. John didn't come. Perdak speaks English.
Imagine that. And that's several hours of just in the training period, not just the experimental. But why do we do this? We do this because this makes different predictions. If the prediction is that you're tracking the probabilistic structure of the input, and we overtrain you on that probabilistic structure, the response profile should be quite different. The response profile should be, when you look at this, so here's now your sentences, here's, you know, the events over time, then we expect the event frequency basically to be tracked, because we've now held fixed transition probability. So I'm not tracking the constituents, that is the grapes put together into larger units, but I'm simply tracking probabilistic structure over time at a particular rate. That's a very popular theory at the moment, and it has a lot of merits. I mean, it does a lot of useful work, this theory. And the question is it right for the brain? And the answer is it is not. I'm not going to go through the whole, and so this is the prediction that should look like this, and let me just cut to the answer. The answer is that it actually looks just like the regular sentences. That is, you don't just track the event rate of the stimulus, but you track the internal rate of the phrases and the transitions between the sentences as well. So it can't be that you're simply tracking transitions or just the surface statistics of the information. It must be that you're actually using the structural information, which is a more provocative and currently unpopular conclusion. Okay. Two more things, and then I think I'm done. So we know we're building structures. They come from your head. They can't come from the stimulus, so you must be using some information. Now, an objection that's very reasonable is nothing ever sounds like this. You know, you don't have isochron speech going word, 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 word. Can you do it? Does this scale up to a more naturalistic context? So suppose I make sentences that are actually just mixed in length and duration and so on. To do another experiment, thank you, reviewer number 3, to track, see if we can track sentences that have different lengths and different structures. Now, there, you can't use the same analysis anymore because you're now no longer presenting isochronous information or frequency tagging the information, which has been a popular technique for 10 years or more. Here, you play variable sentences, right? So sentences that have sometimes a few syllables, sometimes long syllables. Here, I'm just plotting 4 to 8. So here's, here's, let's say, 2.5 seconds of a sentence. And these are the sentences, these are the brain responses, just the power of the brain response for different sentences of different lengths. Here they are, all now put kind of to one, adjusted, normalized to one kind of plot. So at this vertical boundary is the boundary between the previous sentence and the new sentence. Now, as you can see, this goes 5 syllables back. You get a clear dynamics of change across the sentence and a clear onset of a new sentence. But where is that coming from? That also is not in the signal. That is, to track that and to actually see dynamics of constituent structure changing across a natural sentence requires that you had access to it. Either you had to close the bracket of a sentence, or you had to open the bracket of a new sentence, but it doesn't just come for free. You actually need to build that. And if you now make manipulations, for instance, of changing the internal structure of these, so let's say noun phrases that are a little bit shorter or a little bit longer, you can actually show that you differentially track the internal structure of constituent size. Now, we knew already from a very famous paper from, I think, 2011 of Stans and his colleagues, that you're very sensitive to constituent structure, and in fact, you track the dynamics of your brain tracks the size of constituent structure. This basically adds to that in saying that you track that dynamically in real time, that is, you're sensitive to structure size and structure organization. But that doesn't work so easily unless you have the structure, unless you have constituents that are an equivalence class or a kind of computational primitive. That doesn't work. So it must be that this is an argument why you need that infrastructure. Okay, last example. Another reviewer said, this is all very nice and good. You know, I'm kind of happy, but I'd like to know where these signals are coming from. Yes, of course, we all want to know where these signals are, but that's very difficult. With EEG and MEG, given periodic signals of this nature, that's a very difficult problem. Standard source localization techniques can't solve that very well because the sensitivity to correlated sources, and here the correlated signals, these are very much so. So we did a final experiment localizing the sources in, again, patients that have implanted grids, like the ones I showed you for the cocktail party. So same kind of patients, they're in the hospital, they have implanted, each dot is an electrode. This is all the electrodes in three patients, and two patients in the right hemisphere, where they're being recorded. So now we have a direct view of surface recording of the brain, and we know where is this information coming from. And here I just give, it's a little bit preliminary. It's only five patients. It's really not enough data. But what we now do is we do the same experiment, right? So this is English-speaking patients or participants. So they hear the frequency-tagged information. New plans gave hope for the whole time. And the question is, can we track, again, the same response profile? And where is that information? And here's how that looks. So using slightly different analyses. So here's one analysis using one kind of response. So, and when you analyze this kind of data, a very popular method is to look at what's called the power in the high gamma band. There's a very broadband response. It goes from about 80 to 200 hertz. It's not an oscillation, actually. But it's a kind of surrogate for multi-unit neural activity. So it's a good view of brain activity. So when you look, let's look at the high gamma power. So that's local, very localized brain activity. And particularly interesting for me are these red ones down here. So these are the electrodes that showed sensitivity to the phrasal structure building and the sentential structure building, but not the stimulus. I'm not so interested in this. I mean, I kind of know the stimulus is coming from the auditory cortex, right? That's where I put the stimulus. But where is the structure building operation? And here we find it with this analysis kind of more spread. So, some temporal lobe, a little bit of here in the posterior aspect, maybe inferior parietal lobe, and then inferior frontal lobe. So there's not one spot. That's kind of the message. There's not a single spot that says, I'm doing the structure building right here. There's multiple spots doing slightly different things, which again converges in an interesting way with the fMRI data that Stan and Christophe reported a few years ago, using a slightly different technique. So there's not a spot that builds structures, but there's multiple spots that are possibly, this is what has to be investigated, differentially sensitive to sub-operations. If you do it in a slightly different analysis, so that the low-frequency information, that's a little bit more like EEG or MEG data, so it's more compatible with our previous experiments, you see, again, a broad distribution. Again, needs much more subjects, much more analysis, but the when you look at the red dots that are only sensitive to structure building operations, they're in different parts of the head. There's not a strict localization, but there's lots of places sensitive to the elementary aspects of structure building, which is, I think, an important biological message. Okay. In summary, last point. So what have I told you? Well, the brain, or circuitry of cortex, can generate, not just can, does and must, and you know, ubiquitously, generate slow rhythms. And these slow rhythms can actually match the scales of larger structures in speech, even when they're not in the input. That is, as I build these larger sentential structures, I have activity that is able to track, using various mechanisms, these long things. But here's the important kind of conceptual message that's, you know, beyond the kind of experimental minutiae, which are important, but maybe not important for the larger. The larger point is that this tracking that I've demonstrated to you, and tracking of the larger units in particular, is, in our view, based on grammar, on an internal mental grammar, and has nothing to do with either acoustics, because we got rid of it, or statistics, because we got rid of it. So it's an argument that structure building happens necessarily by rule and on the basis of the internal grammatical information that you carry. Now, the linguistic information that we presented is extremely primitive, and it's a linguistic information roughly at the level of 1957, but it's very important. It's structure building operations that you can strip away from statistics or acoustics. It's really the notion of syntactic structures of the mid-50s that's actually at stake, and is an argument in favor of that kind of view. So this is a paper from last year by these lovely postdocs. You can, you know, 5 stars, highly recommended. And the message then is that the temporal structure of speech, whether you're listening to me talking or you're actually building abstract structures, requires that you process on multiple scales. There's the local scale of the signal and ever larger scales, but this happens concurrently. There's, you track little things, you build the little Lego blocks, and then you put the blocks together into larger abstract units at the same time. And that's how you build the representations that underlie our processing and comprehension. And I think that's it. Thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate it.